This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
I'm Ben Gideon. Good to see you, Rahul.
Long time no see, Ben.
So I promised I was going to bring my the mascot in here. Come here, Jacoby. You're going to make an appearance on the show. So he's been fucking to be the official Elevate Podcast mascot. This is Jacoby. He's a rescue dog. He has to come into the office every Wednesday when we record the show because we have house cleaners and other people that come, and he's been known to bite anybody who shows up at our house. It's not direct family relative. He bit the UPS man, bit the garbage man, and now he's no longer allowed there when we have visitors. So he's actually a very sweet dog.
That's funny. What's dog bite liability in Maine?
I'll probably find out soon. No blood drawn on either of those minor nipping events that I would call them. But yeah, he's a good boy, though. With that, we can transition to our guest. Rahul, why don't you do the introduction?
Sure. You know, Ben, it took 3.5 seasons for us to qualify for this, but we've now got the good fortune of having my partner, Brian Panish, on the podcast. Brian, welcome.
Welcome. Good morning.
I think it's fair to say that no other lawyer has been referenced as much on our podcast, even though he hasn't actually appeared in person. Is virtually every episode, there's at least a few minutes where we talk about Brian Panish. So now we can actually hear directly from the man himself. So Brian, I've been thinking about how best to introduce you to our listeners, and there's really very little in the world of trial law you haven't accomplished in your career, not just trying landmark cases, getting landmark verdicts, but also building a world-class firm where you have many other lawyers, including my co-host, who's also out there now getting landmark verdicts, which must feel pretty great as somebody who's mentored all these lawyers who are now having this incredible success.
Well, Ben, I've been so fortunate. I'm so grateful in my life and my career to be surrounded by great people that have helped me get where I've got today. And I've had many mentors through my life, and I think that was very helpful in my career. And certainly we want to carry on the firm long after I'm there, and we're getting everybody positioned and ready to go, and everyone's doing a great job.
So can you take us back to the early days, and who was Brian Panish before you became Brian Panish, the larger-than-life trial lawyer that you are today?
You know, I was just a kid of a family of six kids growing up in Los Angeles. I had a fortune of my father, not when I was born, but eventually became a lawyer. He was going to night law school. I worked as an insurance adjuster. My mom was a nurse, and I was the oldest kid, and as growing up, the one thing that was important to me, pretty much the only thing, was sports. And I played sports every day, all day, every sport. I played in high school, football, basketball, baseball, top-level competition. But just growing up as a kid, that's all we did was play sports all day long. In fact, one of the guys I used to play with was up in the Northeast for a while, and I grew up with Andy Reid, who came all the way from where we grew up in L.A. to be the head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles and now the Super Bowl champion Kansas City Chiefs twice. And so there was just a lot of competition growing up. In my family, there was a lot of competition. And maybe sometimes it was too much, but I was in the mode early on about competing. And obviously, you want to win, but not all about winning, just competing as hard as you can in whatever you're doing, and whether that was athletics, eventually in school. But I wasn't as interested, although I did fine in school. but it was after school that was more interesting to me. And then watching my father and his friends gather at holidays and special occasions or just any time, all they wanted to do was talk about their cases, and they would laugh and have so much fun and talk about the judge, the witness, the jurors. And it seemed to me like something that would be good for me. And so that's why I decided I want to become a lawyer. All of my brothers are lawyers. None of them do what I do. My mom was a nurse. My sister, one's a nurse, one's a doctor. And so our parents really stressed education, and it was a great upbringing to kind of develop into a trial lawyer. You know, a lot of competition, a lot of cross-examination, a lot of action going on growing up.
Did you ever think you might play professional sports?
Oh, that's what I, of course, I did. In fact, I told my dad, what are you going to do when you have to go to college? I said, I want to be in the NFL. He said, oh, okay. Well, in case that doesn't work out, maybe just get good grades so you can maybe go to law school if you're interested. I said, okay. So I got good enough grades. I was a scholar athlete for my university, but then again, the curve maybe wasn't so high.
So you went to Fresno State and you played free safety. When did it become apparent to you that you weren't going to make it into the NFL?
Well, I think maybe towards the end when we have a pro day and you'd run, and I had an injury, I guess my sophomore year, and my speed wasn't as good. And look, I mean, of my team, it's amazing that at least three guys had pretty good NFL careers, one of them being Henry Ellard, who probably played 15 years in the NFL, even for your Patriots for a little while. So just the number of players that go from high school to Division I is very small. The ones that go from Division I or any division to the NFL is much smaller. But when you're thinking you're going to make it, you don't think about the odds. But then when you look back at it, you go, it's a pretty hard thing, and very few people make it, although I've been blessed to have grown up with people that did make it in professional athletics.
And some people, when they, like, their childhood dream dies on them, that can be a moment where you become depressed and, you know, lose your way. But that happened to you at all? Or did you know right away that you wanted to move on to, you know, becoming a lawyer like your dad?
No, I was a high school football coach. So when I graduated, I was teaching and coaching football in my high school, St. John Bosco High School, defending 2022 national championships for high school football. And that's when I started playing football. All right, when I got done, I realized, you know, there's more to it.
And I'll let Rahul jump in anytime. I'm just cognizant of your Wi-Fi issues today.
No, appreciate it.
But can I ask you one more question about football? So obviously, you had a great career playing football. You were a free safety, which I imagine involved running at high speeds and smashing into people. And now you do a career that requires you to use your brain. Do you have a concern about the effects of football on cognitive functioning from your own experience? And would you let I know you have a son, did he play football? Would you feel comfortable with your own children playing?
He never played tackle football. I would feel, in the right circumstance, certainly I would do it again. Do I have concerns? Not really. I mean, I think I'm doing pretty good so far.
Not about you.
I know. I think I have concerns about people. No question. I mean, I was watching yesterday, the NFL has changed the kickoff rule. And it seems, although they're very contradictory in the changes they make, but they seem to be concerned about safety. Obviously, CTE is a real problem. I know people that have suffered from it, that have died, that had, you know, that were tested and had it. So it's a real problem. But then again, you know, the game is a physical game, and that's part of the game now. Some of the hits that were occurring, you know, when I was playing, they would never be allowed to do that today. So it's changed, but the violence and the physicality is still there. That's a big part of the game.
What's the parallel, do you think, between competitive sports and trial law?
Perseverance and passion for what you're doing, never giving up. It's temporary setbacks. My college coach would always say, you know, got to drop a ball or make a mistake. He goes, temporary setback. And yet all these things, he was a big influence, Jim Sweeney. He had all these things. He was the son of a hard rock miner, immigrant and from Ireland to Butte, Montana, made it out of there to be a successful Division I coach. And he would always stress, you know, discipline, accountability was his favorite. And I think as a trial lawyer, accountability is big, and not only from what you're trying to do for your clients, but from your own perspective in trying the case, there's certain risks or things you may do, you may be held accountable, and there's consequences for things you do. So I think discipline, accountability, the ability to work with a team. You know, you have to be in sync with 10 other players. There's 11 players at one time. If one player doesn't do their job, then the other team be successful. And so to be able to work together, some people you're not getting along with them, you don't like them, but you have to get along with them. You're in the same team, you're in the same meeting room, you're in the same individual drills all the time. So you're required to get along and be part of a team and put the team above you. All those things, I think, translate into trial. But hey, football, when you lose, you know, we had the 24-hour rule. You could be sad or happy for one day, then you got to get back to it because you have a game the next week. Usually in the trial law business, not always, but usually you finish a trial and it may be months, years before there's another trial. And you keep thinking about it, where in the football, you just ride back into it the next week.
So when you talk about discipline, Brian, discipline, does it mean different things at different stages? So if you're in a trial, how do you define discipline to get to the finish line and to be successful time and time again?
Well, I mean, it starts before the trial, obviously preparing, doing all the work that's necessary, focus groups, whatever. But in the trial, I mean, you have to stick to a regimen. I have my own. I wake up very early, go to sleep early, try to work out, working down all the time down the courthouse in the morning. I get early, go there early. I work, working at lunchtime after, you know, I do a lot of work early in the morning. I feel the freshest then, preparing it, maybe, you know, 4:30, 5 a.m., get some solid few hours in there. An hour lunch, then a little bit when you get home. So it's just a discipline to keep doing it and to not let up. Again, the trial is kind of like a game, and they're keeping score. So we like to keep scoring and scoring. We don't care if the score is 30 to nothing. That's not enough. We want to keep pushing every day to be overly persuasive.
What's your favorite part of trial? I feel like I know what I think your favorite part of trial is, but...
Well, I mean, the whole thing from the, I can tell you what my least favorite is. That's the jury deliberations. I think every lawyer, you know, you lose control. So yeah, that's hard for me. The jury deliberations, the whole process is fun for me. My family, they tell me that I'm in a much better mood when I'm in trial and I'm happy that I'm doing what I like to do. But I mean, I would always say, well, cross-examination, I love cross-examining. Every lawyer says that. But I think that as time has gone on, I've done, you know, 150 or 60 trials. There's other things you like. I really start to really like the direct examinations of the plaintiffs and telling their story. I really like that. I spend a lot of time on that. And I love the final argument, whether it means a difference, makes a difference or not. That really is up to debate. But it's fun for the lawyers to argue and practice all these things you've thought about for years and persuade the jury. And I think really I always, at the end of the trial, when the verdict's read, hopefully we won. I have a feeling of relief that we didn't lose and the client's going to be okay. And really that's what's driving us all the time, is to do what's right for the client. And if you keep that in mind, you'll be fine.
Going back in time, I think most people have heard about your $4.9 billion verdict in the Anderson versus GM case. But if you go back before that, is there kind of a most significant case as a turning point in your own career as a trial lawyer where you decided that this is something I'm really good at and I really love doing this? And this case was really meaningful to me in some way that...
Ben, I got to tell you, when I was in law school, these buddies of mine from New York had this externship at the district attorney. And what they would do is preliminary hearing. Because in those days, a preliminary hearing, if you had to put on the whole case to make a showing that they could be bound over, held up, go to trial. And yet now it's much more abbreviated in California. There's let hearsay in and things like that. Where before, you had to call the officers, whoever, and make your case. So in law school, I went in. They said, you got to sign up for this. So I signed up. I went in there, and I did like 100 prelims in law school. And what we would do is, in those days, they'd always, after the preliminary hearing, they'd make a transcript, they'd put it in the file, and it would go to the next court. So we would go get the transcripts and review them and critique each other. Like, how many times you said, okay, or uh-huh, after the question. You read the transcript, it doesn't look as good as you thought you were doing. So from that time on, I knew this is what I wanted. I started off, I worked in numerous jobs in law school. I always had at least one or two jobs in law firms, U.S. attorney, district attorney, civil defense, the firm where I eventually worked. And then I got to do, I think, about 15 trials in the first 20 6 months. All of them were defense cases, two plaintiff cases, which we won. But I got to do a lot of defense trials. And just being in the trial, and since I was young and married, I would go out of town. They would give me the out-of-town trials in all these outlying counties in California. And one of the areas that became known as that, we represent Lloyd's of London. And Lloyd's of London, the firm primarily started off as aviation. So they had big plane crashes, small plane crashes, helicopters, things like that. And one of the businesses that Lloyd's was involved in was crop dusting. So I then was the one that would go in through all these farm towns and counties throughout California trying these crop drift cases where a crop duster, either by plane or helicopter, would apply chemicals and they would claim that it had drifted and things like that. So I was the crop dusting expert in all over California. So that's how I started out. But I liked it and it was fun and got to meet the farmers and all the people. And I had a great time going all over the place doing trials. Eventually, 1987, Brown Green, who was a renowned trial lawyer at the time and still to this 86 years old, got a verdict this year. He recruited me to his firm, which at the time, I believe, was the top plaintiff firm in the state of California. They had numerous lawyers, trials going all the time. And so eventually I went over there and I lost my first three trials. You know, this one, Brown Green gives me this file, you know, a week before the trial. Here, here's this great case for our client. Crossing the street in a crosswalk, he got hit by a drunk driver. Okay, sounds pretty good. Well, I read the file, and the other guy was pretty drunk. He didn't skid until 250 feet after he hit our guy. But our guy was really drunk, too, and the case was not against the drunk driver. The case was against the county for having inadequate lighting. So I had to go out to Riverside, which I had to leave my house where I lived in Santa Monica on the beach, drive to my office, do a little work in the morning, pick up the clients who lived in the Appalachian Mountains in Tennessee, and then drive to Riverside about an hour and 15 minutes. Try the case all day, drive the clients back. They took a bus back to where they were staying. Do work in the office, drive back to my house, and then get up, you know, 4:30 in the morning, do it every day. And I thought I was going to win the case. And I almost got non-suited in the opening statement. That's how I started. And eventually, the case goes to the jury, and the jury finds dangerous condition. And they write a letter to the city they got to fix it, but they say there's no causation. They say there could have been beacon lights out there, and the guy was so drunk he wouldn't have seen anything. I lost the case, and I proceeded to lose. The next case was another hard road design case for a paralyzed guy. Had to drop him off at his home lab, tell him, you know, good luck with your life after losing that case. Lost the next case, a product liability crane tip over case, but we was able to get a good settlement with the contractor. And then finally, I guess the case that really caused me to just, if I wasn't already in love with, overly in love with the trial, was the case of Rostello versus City of Torrance Police Department. It was a 1983 civil rights case where a young 19-year-old Kelly Rostello, the youngest of nine children living in San Pedro, was driving home from visiting his girlfriend on a motorcycle in Palos Verdes, California, when an off-duty member of the Torrance Police Department, Rollo Green, a homicide detective, made a sharp left turn, kind of cut in the butt, as they say. Kelly Rostello hit him, killed. Well, turns out that the police engaged in a massive cover-up, that the officer had been drinking. And this proceeded to be a five-year battle. The first day I showed up at Brown Green's office, you know, I'm here to be the big trial lawyer, and I stand up. I go in, they give me this nice office, and there's a motion that's like a month of foot and a half high. And I remember I started on February 1st, and it's like due in red written across February 17th. I started looking at this thing. I'm like, oh, my God. I came here to try the cases, not write oppositions and motions. Yes, I never been in a 1983 case, really. And it was a difficult case in finding what was the constitutional right that was violated. But what happened was the secretary came in and said to me, hey, don't sweat it. The brother of the plaintiff, of the guy that died, is a big lawyer in Colorado, and his whole firm is working on the case. And they'll prepare the opposition. You just have to go to court. And so I proceeded for almost 2 years to work on that case with the brother, Tim Rostello, hundreds of depositions, and we went to trial. And it was at the time, civil cases were not really in the newspaper, but but there was a section of the LA Times which they called the Metro section, where they have, and so every day in the Metro section there was an article about the case. And at the very end, they had pictures of the police when they found them all liable and got punitive damages. And so that was kind of the first case that really caused me to say, hey, I'm good at this. I like it. I don't mind the work. And I love being able to vindicate Mr. and Mrs. Rostello. Interesting, during the trial, right before the trial, Mrs. Rostello died from cancer. And so in California law at the time, and really now, the case does not survive the death of the plaintiff. But under federal law, federal common law does, and since it was a 1983 case, federal law would dominate in the field, therefore, and federal law would apply, even though California law didn't allow it, you could still recover under federal common law, in which we did, and the mom received, you know, multiple million dollars, but she wasn't even there to testify. We actually read her deposition at the trial, and that was in, that happened on August 1990, so it was a long journey, and that was kind of the first case that I was got recognition. People knew me. You know, it was a newspaper that always kind of puts your name out there. TV is even more alerting to the public. So that was the case. Rostello versus the City of Torrance. We ended up getting the verdict. We ended up going to appeal. Ended up getting affirmed. We ended up getting $2 or $3 million in attorney fees under 1988, the statute for attorney fees. The judge said a lot of nice things about us. So that was started up.
What year was that?
I think 1989. So we're cased for about 2.5 years, but in between losing those other cases.
When you lost those three cases in a row, did you ever have a moment of doubt about your abilities or your career choice or anything like that?
Well, then I thought, man, this is hard. I was winning all these other cases. I come here, I'm losing these cases. But in reality, I thought I won. I think I won in the courtroom. But it's just the facts I couldn't overcome. And it was great learning. I got to learn so much, like in a paraplegic case. I'm trying my second plaintiff case to the paraplegic. So I'm learning all the life care plans and problems in paraplegic. What I didn't know that before. And all the things that go along with putting on a case for a catastrophically injured person. So I learned a lot that way, cross-examining. But I thought I won the cases. And I think looking back now, based on what happened in the courtroom, maybe one case. The other case, I think that we won, but the case was too hard to get quick facts.
What's changed in the practice of law for the better and for the worse since you started until now?
Well, for the worse, I mean, it's just discovery disputes, the depositions of the experts, how much time that takes, and the cost prosecuting these cases is just astronomically gone up. You need more experts. Trial technology, when I first started out, was butcher paper or maybe blow-ups. That, you know, you have 150 blow-ups you'd be whipping through in the trial. Eventually, it was about 92, some guy came to me with this PowerPoint. It was in the infancy. And the first trial I used in the final argument, I had an overhead projector, and I would just put the individual slides printed out on the projector and talk. Or it's like an Elmo, I guess it was whatever at the time. Remember Elmo? So that's changed dramatically. The cost, how these cases are defended much more vigorously. The insurance companies are much, I believe, tougher, fighting harder. And on the good side, I think there's been a lot of education of lawyers, a lot of sharing, training that's really enhanced and increased the ability of the plaintiff lawyers. The verdicts have certainly, in the last few years, have really risen, I think. People trying cases with these skills have been able to get better verdicts. I think maybe jurors are a little more attuned to what really is going on in these cases. And that's good. But I would say a lot of things aren't good that have changed in the practice. And a lot of times it's much more difficult for the plaintiff to recover. There's many more barriers. When I first started, we had joint several. Everything was, if you got 1%, they owed it all. That went away in 1987 by a ballot initiative. Then they went for caps on attorney fees. We have caps on damages and malpractice cases. And they're chipping away at the tort system and the fight that's always occurring, especially in the tort system, damages and things like that. It's been a never-ending battle, and it continues on to this day.
Can you talk a little bit about the Anderson case? I know we had Bob Kelly on, and he wrote a book. Have you read his book about the GM litigation?
Sure. I read it before, and he was... So Anderson was a woman, Patricia Anderson, African-American, South Central Los Angeles, December 24th. She had her four kids with her and a friend. She'd picked up Joe Tigner. They were coming home from church on Christmas Eve. She's going to the store to buy the kids some candy and some milk. This is in South Central Los Angeles, which was not a great place, part of town at the time. They were stopped for a red light, and another vehicle approached, rear-ended the vehicle. The vehicle caught on fire. All the children had varying degrees of burns, several of them very severe. Patricia Anderson viewed it all. Joe Tigner had burns. They were all taken to different and had other general motors cases similar to this. So we had them going at the time. The vehicle looked very damaged. Eventually at the trial, GM claimed the other car was going 90. We said it was only 50 and that there were crash tests that they had done with the alternative design at 50 to 50 car to car. That there had been no leakage in the gas tank. So we proceeded on this journey of going back, myself and Christine Spagnoli, we worked together at the time, going back to Detroit, taking positions, networking with lawyers around the country that have been in other cases. That in comes Bob Kelly. He had won his verdict down in Florida, Fort Lauderdale. We flew down there, him, Shelley Schlesinger, and John Ustahl, who tried the case with him. All three of them were very helpful. Tons of information, trial transcripts. And at this time, there was a big fight. There was a memo called the Ivy Memo. This came out in the 70s. The Ivy Memo was basically a cost-benefit analysis that if they changed the design, how much it would cost versus how much they were paying out in the lawsuits. And they decided basically that it was cheaper to fight the lawsuits than to make the design change. And so that memo came out, and over the years, Mr. Ivy testified that he did that on his lunch break. It was his own project. He never shared it with anyone. And he probably gave 15 to 20 depositions where he said that nobody was really able to get the document into evidence. It's a case called Shoemaker versus General Motors, tried by Bob Langdon, Ken Emerson, down in Missouri. And they were able to get the Ivy memo into evidence the first time. And during the course of that, they were able to get, under the crime fraud exception to the attorney-client privileges, memos, interview notes of lawyers that had interviewed Ivy and got all this information, including the complete opposite of what he'd already been testified to. Then a lawyer down in Mississippi who's had a case, Ed Saunders, I went down to Atlanta to meet with him, and he delivers to me Mr. Ivy's personnel file. It shows that during the time when General Motors was having a huge crisis, the country having the big problem with the emissions from the motor vehicles. And Mr. Ivy, when they were laying off all these people, Mr. Ivy got a 25% raise right before his first deposition. So now we were able to put the personnel file together with the depositions. And during the trial, another lawyer, Bruce Pelway in Birmingham, Alabama, took Ivy's deposition with the new documents, which we never did. And we were able to play that. We were also able to get in testimony from H.R. Halderman, who was the White House counsel at the time, with meetings, General Motors and Ford, Firestone meeting with Halderman, who's alleged payoffs of money because they were trying to adopt new federal motor vehicle safety standards that would have required the cars to pass a 50 to 50 car to car versus a 30 mile an hour moving barrier test, which was the self-certification test that they just do the test and they say, okay, we meet the standards. No one's checking. So we put all that together, went through a three-month trial, and we had a great judge, Ernest George Williams. And the other side had these lawyers that primarily what they did was go around the country and defend these cases. They call them PCFFF, post-collision fuel-fed fire, and then if you add another F for fatality. So PCFFFF cases. And the trial went on for 3 months. It was going pretty good. We were calling their experts out of order. I had said in the opening statement that we have to play all these videos. General Motors is outside the subpoena jurisdiction of the court, and we're not able to call them, so we apologize that we have to play all these videotapes. And then the lawyer for GM gets up in the opening statement and says, any witness he wants, we'll bring him. So I get to call in these witnesses I would have never got with all these other documents I had. I would cross-examine them for days. Some of these guys' days. And it was fun. The jury goes out. Remember, it was right before 4th of July weekend. And They looked good. They went home for 4th of July, felt good. Came back on Monday. They gave $109 million compensatory damages. And then we went to the punitive damage phase. They made a finding of yes, 11-1. And then we went to the punitive damage phase. And in the opening statement, prior to this, maybe 6 months, Jim Butler, a great lawyer from Columbus, Georgia, had tried a side saddle. It was a pickup truck where the gas tank was on the side. And Mosley had been in a collision. He burned to death. He got a couple $100 million. And I read the transcript. He helped me with everything. And in it, the General Motors lawyer at that time, Fred Bartlett, Kirkland and Ellis, is a fine lawyer, said in the opening thing, well, I've gone up to Detroit and I've talked to them and they've got the message and they're going to make changes and you don't need to punish them anymore. So I said, well, I'll be saying, well, you know, Mr. Greenfield, that was his name. He's going to come in here. And remember, he doesn't work for me. And he's going to tell you how they're sorry and that they got the message and all this. So when he says that, don't really believe it. So he gets up and says, well, I'm not apologizing for anything. This is a jury already gave $109 million against his client. We're not, this is 1999 too, $109 million is real money. He says, we're not apologizing for anything. We haven't done anything wrong. So then we proceed with a one-day trial, punitive damages. Jury comes out. I argue, you know, General Motors making $2.4 billion a week. And they were bragging the whole time, we're the largest corporation in the world. We would never do these things. And he says we do, and so on. And I said, you know, it's kind of like if you have a good player on your team, and they did wrong, but you don't want to kick them off the team. So what do? You suspend them, and you dock them pay. So what we used to do is suspend General Motors 2 weeks and dock them 2 weeks' pay, $4.8 billion. And that's what they did. They gave $4.8 billion in damages plus $109 million. Compensatory. And so then it just took off in the media. At that time, CNN had this thing called headline news. So I had, if you remember that, every 15 minutes they'd come with the news stories. Well, because the verdict was so large, I was concerned. We were all concerned of the tort reform, and everyone's going to come out and say, you know, there's never been this $1 billion ever, and say, this is the jury system's out of control. So what I did, got everything. The verdict maybe came in like 9:30. So I talked to some people, and what I did is I got all the jurors to come at 12 o'clock and stand behind me with the other lawyers on the team. Then I had the worst burden, one plaintiff stand in front of me with arms burning the face. People were seeing it. So for a week, maybe more, every 15 minutes, the girl's picture and me were on CNN all over the world, and everyone in the world was calling me. I mean, it's like, the case is so horrible that what happened to the girl. Nobody was focusing in on how much the money was. This is a lot of money. And then we said to General Motors, okay, we'll give you back all the punitive damages. We'll waive it if you change the design. Eventually, the judge cut the verdict to $1 billion, like $200 million. And then eventually, it settled. I can't tell you how much, but eventually, it was just me, general counsel from General Motors, and Mike Zmirsky, who was the head guy for the money, some hotel. And then at 3 o'clock of the day, it was kind of a non-glorious ending, but we're happy about it. And everyone was taken care of. And I learned a ton. And interesting is I taped a 2020 episode all about the case. And they go, okay, it's going to be on Friday night. So this is 1999. So this is when I had an old satellite dish. I was going to get the Fresno State game. And I would, you know, the 8-foot thing, you have to turn, make all these noises. And so it was on whatever it was, NBC or CBS. But since the East Coast time, it would be coming on at 10 or 9. It would be 6 o'clock in California. So a few of my friends came over. We were going to watch it. And we watched it. And right then, they announced that JFK Jr. had crashed flying the plane. And we were totally off the map. No more reference to the trial. And that's what happened. And that's what shows you, no matter what's going on in the world at the time this happens, you could have this great newsworthy thing and someone would just black you right out with more newsworthy event. So that's kind of my little summary on the Anderson case.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. There's a lot of millennials and Gen Z like to use the term, we're going to change the world, you know. But from a trial lawyer standpoint, that really did change the world, didn't it? In certain ways, probably for you personally and professionally, but also the trial world. Because had anybody seen those kind of verdicts before that?
No, not in the billions in California. Although Joe Jamail, in maybe he's in the 80s, he got a billions in Texas on a case, the Exxon Pennzoil case. But no, that hadn't happened. And certainly when it started out, I didn't know we were going to get a $1 billion verdict. It's just how the trial went and everything went so well. The witnesses, all the people turned out, and it really went well. So yeah, it was kind of a thing that said to other people, hey, you can get these big verdicts. You just got to try the cases, have the right case.
And I do recommend anybody who's interested should read Bob Kelly's book. It's really well done. And it kind of lays out the background that leads up to before you tried your case, Brian. But the other great part about that story is how many lawyers contributed to the final result by accomplishing little pieces of that over many, many years, and then being willing to share that information among the trial bar so that you had access to that.
Well, they were all calling me after the verdict because they felt that there were other people that contributed. Paul Lewis was a consultant down in Alabama to help me. And they were all calling me that night because they felt they were part of that verdict, and they were. And we would not have been able to obtain that result without the help of all these lawyers. And that's what the plaintiff lawyers have to do to be able to compete with these large corporations and their lawyers and resources that they have. I think we're doing a much better job of that, of sharing. And at the time, I was very active in the AIEG, Attorney Information Exchange Group, which many of these lawyers I met through that, and they're very, one of the big things is about sharing information, helping others, and that all did pay off, and we could never have got the result we did without all those people helping us, and we're very grateful to them, and they shared in it too.
That's what I was going to ask. So was it through AIEG that you all connected, or how did you all become a network?
Pretty much. So I knew Emerson and Langdon through that. I knew Sanders through that. I knew Butler through that. So I would say, yeah, pretty much through AIEG, started doing those automobile product liability cases. They were hard. You had to learn a lot. Spent a lot of time in Detroit. Haven't really been back for a while. Not dying to go back, but many, many nights, cold winters in Detroit.
So after 18 years at Green Broillat, you decided to leave a very successful trial firm and to start your own practice, which I can kind of relate to, not at the same level of success, but I was at my former firm for 17 years. What was it that made you decide to leave and start your own firm?
I think a few things. Number one, I felt that I kind of wanted to do it the way I wanted to do it, and everything was going fine in the other firm. It wasn't like, you know, the firm wasn't doing well. The firm was doing pretty well, but I felt like I wanted to kind of do it my own way. Certain things I want to do a little differently. And I felt that now was the time. I mean, people would always ask me after the GM case, why didn't you leave your firm and do all this? I said, well, I liked it there. I liked the people. I didn't really have a reason, and I had younger children, so it wasn't the right time. And then in 2005, 6 years later, I tried a lot more cases. I won a lot more, you know, large verdicts. We had a lot of business. I decided, you know, it's time to do it and see what's going to happen. What's the worst thing's going to happen? I could probably come back. So I walked out of that office April of 2005 and started a firm with four lawyers. Had no desks, sitting on boxes. I immediately was in a trial. Burbank got a good verdict. And then immediately had to go do another trial with Kevin Boyle up in San Francisco. We got a record verdict there. And we started off doing well. Although at the same time, Adam Shea, our other partner, doing a trial with our old firm on a product liability automobile case, and they lost. So right away we learned, you know, you can lose, you can win, and you get some roller coasters of emotion. And that's what happened. And today, you know, it's grown much larger. I couldn't tell you exactly how many attorneys, 45 to 50, depending.
When it's large enough that you don't know, it's pretty large.
Well, I mean, I don't have the exact number, but I mean, I know all the people. But, you know, then we have multiple offices and a lot of great lawyers and continuing on to do what we've wanted to do and helping people and making a difference in people's lives.
I remember when Brian called me up and brought me into the firm in 2016, and I met with him and Kevin Boyle.
I think I should tell the story.
Okay.
Okay. So what happened was Raul was working as a law clerk in the firm. He wasn't really, I think he was working with Jeff Wells primarily, who I brought in the firm, used to be my roommate but after law school. He's a great guy. So we were able to help him get a job, the firm that I used to work at, Engstrom, Lipscomb, and Lack. In fact, it goes all the way back to them having been tenants of my father when he had his law firm when they first started off. So I've known them since I was a kid. And I had a great experience there. And another friend of my dad's, this Jerry Ramsey, who's a big lawyer, insurance man, he calls me up. He goes, "Hey, you got to save Raul." I go, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Raul's going to the Cochran firm. So you need to save him." So I called him up. We met, and then he came to work with us. So I guess I saved him. Although the Cochran firm is fine, but it's different. So, and Johnny Cochran wasn't there.
All an absolutely true story. And then when we met, I think it was at the Palomino out on Wilshire.
Palomino Westwood.
Yep. And one of the questions, I asked the same question, Ben, that you just asked to Brian, like, why'd you leave and what did you want to change? And he said, at that time, Brian, you said, "I just want to be a smaller firm." And Green Barlett, I think, was 16 lawyers or 20 lawyers at that time when you left. So what changed between that and now, where we're now a 40, 45, 50 lawyer firm?
All right. Well, your audio is bad, but I think so. What's changed from, you know, four lawyers and whatever number there is now? And I think, you know, it's the clients. You got so many clients, you got to take care of them. You got to have adequate staffing and resources and people to do the cases. And it was working. And so we kept going with it. We didn't really set out to have 50 lawyers. We didn't set out to have law offices in other states, but that's just how it turned. And you have to be flexible and be able to make moves as it occurs in the practice of law, because things change constantly.
And you've been involved in, I mean, you mentioned the Bobby Kennedy Jr. and it wiped you off the front pages, but you've managed to get yourself back on the front pages.
Oh, that was JFK Jr. JFK Jr.
JFK Jr. That's right. Sorry. But you've been back on the front pages many times, and you're involved in, I think, the Kobe Bryant helicopter crash case and the Alec Baldwin shooting case and Michael Jackson case. I mean, you're involved in all of these high profile cases that we're constantly reading about on the front page of the papers now, even outside of California. How do you manage to find yourself on all of these high profile cases?
Well, I think a lot of good luck and a lot of hard work and perseverance and really taking care of the clients. In the end of the day, the clients are your best recommendations. They're going to say how you did. And I always tell people when they're trying to decide who their lawyer is, that, you know, you can call some of our clients and ask them. Were we always as nice as we are on the first day when we signed you up? Did we call you back? Did you feel like you were involved in your case? And I think if you do good work, people are going to recognize that and you're going to get business and people are going to contact you because they think they want you to handle their case. You know, some high profile cases are more difficult than others. So be careful what you wish for. Being in the newspaper and all that is not always the greatest thing. Having people follow you around and reporters is not the greatest. So everyone that strives to be in the media, that's great. But there's a lot of other things that come with it that they don't talk about.
So when we were preparing for doing your podcast episode, Rahul asked me, was there something in particular I wanted to ask you? And here's what I told him, and I do want to ask you about this. So you have lawyers like Rahul that are now out there killing it, getting huge verdicts, getting a lot of personal recognition and fame and success on their own terms. Do you ever feel like that diminishes the focus on you as being kind of the top dog and the lead guy there? Or do you feel more pride in all of the lawyers that you've mentored now having this kind of incredible level of success following in your footsteps?
I think that you are who you hang out with, and they all make me proud that they're able to go out and do this, and I'm not involved at all. They're on their own doing these trials. you know, people say to me, oh, it's a great verdict. I go, I didn't get the verdict. Raul got the verdict. Or David Rudolph forgot the verdict. And it's great that other lawyers could do it. I think it's important to have depth on any team. And I think we have an incredible depth. We have people that have learned the way we work up our cases and we try them. And I think we have a pretty good system of the teams that work together. I think everybody's committed. Nobody's trying to, you know, be the person. They understand that it's a team and I'm not the person that's doing everything. I couldn't do this. And there's a lot of other people that are doing great things in the firm. I just have to be the oldest person. So they look to me, but there are many, many people in the firm that make it a success. And that's really the key, to have a great team and a great depth and many people that can go try cases and get large verdicts.
What advice do you give to lawyers that are just getting started in the career now and want to find a way to have success? They look at people like you and Rahul, and you're so, it seems almost unimaginable that someone, how did you get to that point and the things that you guys are able to do? And what would you tell them?
I would say, number one, make sure what you're doing is what you want to do. Because being a trial lawyer, unless you love it, it's very hard. It's kind of like football. If you don't really like it, it's a terrible thing to go through what you have to go through, and the contact and the practices and the soreness and just all those things. If you don't love it, you shouldn't do it. So if you don't really love this lawyering part, then you should go do something else because it's hard, number one. Number two, you have to get into it all in. You have to learn everything you can, soak up everything you can, go to as many seminars, talk to lawyers, watch trials, do all that. Number three, you got to have always be concerned about your reputation because your reputation that you take years to build up, you can lose it in a few minutes. And lawyers are really judged on their reputation. People say, oh, that person, you can trust that person. Oh, you got to watch them. They'll pull this or they're good for that. And I think that's critical for your reputation, not only with other lawyers, but with the judges. I mean, the judges talk to, if you're a lawyer that's difficult for the court, other judges are going to know that's going to hurt your clients. And civility, getting along with others is critical. I mean, you know, we're in this society today where everything's a fight. Trials are a fight and themselves are very hard. So to try to make civil with the other side, I think makes everything a lot easier. And you're going to end up coming out ahead on that deal. Now, it's not always possible, unfortunately, but striving for that is good. Now, myself, I haven't always been the best example of that, and I'm the first to admit it. But as I go on and on in the practice, I recognize how important it is. And to be a plaintiff lawyer, I mean, it's kind of like a roller coaster. My first boss, I was doing a trial with him, we're driving home from court. He's from Oklahoma. He said, you know, Brian, you know what the greatest... He says, there's no greater feeling than driving back to the office after having a great day. He goes, but there's no worse feeling driving back to the office having a bad day in court. And what you need to do, it's like a roller coaster, and you need to keep yourself in the middle. You can't get up too high. You can't get too low in these trials because they're going to go up and down all the time. Don't make any decisions after you had a bad day. Never settle a case after you had a bad day in court. And so I've tried to keep that perspective, although it's hard at times when things go bad. If things going good, I don't get overly confident. Things go bad, I get worried. Because one thing in a trial really could sink the whole case. So you really have to be careful and be careful watching and be prepared and know what they're going to do to anticipate. So I'd say those would be the things, the reputation, to learn everything you can about the subject matter and to kind of keep an even keel if you can. It's a very emotional business. I mean, that's why there's so many divorces, substance abuse with lawyers, mental illness issues. It's very hard. It's not for everyone. And you need to stay in good physical condition to be able to do this.
That's really great advice. And it was very well articulated. I hope our listeners take that to heart. I really do, because there's a lot there. Well, I really appreciate you joining us on the podcast, Brian. I mean, this has been a great learning experience for me.
I got to say that you and Brian doesn't take compliments very well, but I'm going to compliment you. You've been throughout at least my career for the last 23 years. And I think this, I'm speaking on behalf of everybody who's been able to work with you or for you, a true leader by example. You're the guy who's the hardest working person in the office day in and day out. And I think that truly is what changed and grown this from what it was to the size that it is now, with everybody from top to bottom being truly inspired to do our best for our clients. So you have created a legacy that's continuing to grow, and I'm just super proud of you. So it's proud to be your partner.
Well, I'm proud of all you guys. Thanks for having me here today, and look forward to doing it again.
Thanks, Brian.
All right.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.